Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host, with this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. As the world continues to take unnerving and unpredictable twists and turns, this morning we check in again with Eric DePlace, Policy Director for Sightline Institute in Seattle, to gain some perspective on the craziness that abounds. We'll do a mashup of everything that's frightening and confusing us, unprecedented mega wildfires, repetitive Category 4 hurricanes, and a Republican Party intent on dismantling America's social contract, and draw some lessons that enable us to continue to plug ahead towards a livable future. Eric, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Good morning, Barbara. Sounds like a tall order.
I was just thinking that. I figured since the last time we talked, something else would be a big breaking story. So today, Paul Manafort has been arrested. And right. So let's kind of wrap that into the wildfires, hurricanes, and general Trumpisms.
Yeah, that's a tough word. I got the news alert on my phone this morning right when I woke up. And, it illustrates just what a strange time that we're living in right now. I mean, it seems like everything that we have relied on, whether it's kind of a stable democracy or a relatively stable climate, is coming unraveled right before our eyes. And I think as much as anybody else, I'm having a difficult time kind of piecing together what our new reality will look like here in the Northwest and well beyond.
Well, I've been having conversations like that, particularly about climate issues, with a lot of friends. And I keep coming back to this really strange word I learned a few years ago from an ecologist. It's the word stationarity. Are you familiar with that one?
I'm not. It's
a weird word. It's an engineering term, and it's something you can throw out the window now. What it means is basically that you can rely on the past to make plans for the future, and it's particularly in terms of climate and other things that would make you, would figure into making plans for how to build bridges, dams, other kinds of major infrastructure. And this ecologist sent me a paper, this is about, I don't know, 5 years ago, about how a number of engineers were beginning to believe that stationarity was over, that they could not count on it anymore.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's and I've been thinking about that ever since I read the paper, because it's very disconcerting. But it's interesting how it's not just engineers anymore who are talking about not being able to rely on the data from the past in order to really project into the future, but it's everybody is beginning to feel this. And I thought maybe that's a way to kind of frame what's going on. I'm hoping we can do today is sort of look at all the weird stuff that's happening within the larger context of the fact that Trump is president of the United States, and how that, I mean, it's not his fault that we're having these Category 4 hurricanes or that we're having wildfires, but somehow the denial that brought him into power makes me think that's what's at fault. And I wonder if we can kind of wrap our brains around that.
Yeah. I think putting our finger on the denial is probably the right place to put it, because, you know, to me, what's happened with, American democracy is perhaps similar to what's happening with the climate, where we have this sense that something's gone wrong, but everything's still fine, it's still fine. And then all of a sudden, it's not fine anymore. It's like, it has slowly been eroded, it's been corroded and corrupted until suddenly there's this, dramatic change, and Donald Trump takes office and begins to sort of violate or rearrange all the norms of the way that the presidency is supposed to work in American democracy. It works. And I kind of have this sense that we're doing the same thing with the climate, where, scientists have been saying, really screaming since the 1980s, we've got a profound climate change problem, but, everything continues along more or less as normal. And then all of a sudden it's not normal anymore. It's not reversible anymore. And gosh, it was hard to kind of experience this summer and not feel a little bit like the ground had collapsed beneath our feet. Both of the hurricanes and, of course, the wildfires in the West, and it feels like every week or so we get some new scientific assessment that's even a little more bleak than the one previous.
Well, I did a show last week about, it was kind of an update on the Eagle Creek fire, and I talked to Peter Cornelison, who's with Friends of the Columbia River Gorge, and he was stating something I've been hearing from a lot of environmental groups in Oregon, that basically the fire did what fires are supposed to do in wildlands, and it was actually an ecologically healthy fire. And so in a way, it was not anything out of the ordinary, except that I have a little bit of trouble connecting with that, partly because of how the fire was started. But I also drove through the gorge, all the way through the gorge for the first time last week, and I didn't think that the fire was as invisible from the road as a lot of people had said. And it made me, the way that it burnt all the way down to the highway and the extent of it and the the very obvious damage that needs to be repaired is not something I've seen in other wildfires in this area. So I'm wondering if maybe there's a little bit of denial going on right there, too, amongst environmentalists who want to see a happy ending to something like what felt like a real tragic event of the Gorge Fire. And I wonder how, you know, kind of balancing that, because I do understand that wildfires are important and they can serve a purpose even if they're set by human beings. But somehow this one seemed, it makes me uncomfortable to put it into the old pattern of, well, this is what the forest needs.
Yeah, I mean, don't we all want a happy ending on some level? We all want to believe that things are going to be okay. And I mean, maybe they will be. I hope they are. But maybe they won't be. There's no guarantee that they will be. I'm not an expert in, you know, forest ecology or wildland fire to really have an informed opinion, except that when I have read the sort of regional projections, including from the Climate Impacts Group out of UW, but also there are similar ones from Oregon State, you know, the folks have looked at wildland fires that sort of said, well, we've had this really disrupted, kind of screwed up ecosystem management approach for a century. You know, fire suppression and other things have contributed to an environment that's more and more likely to ignite large wildfires. And then climate acts on top of that as an accelerant, as a catalyst that makes the problem even worse. You know, so it, like with anything, there's never going to be just one single cause where it's only climate change that's involved. But by the same token, we can't say that climate change isn't a factor. We can't say that climate change doesn't contribute because the science sort of suggests that it does now and will in the future. But there's something about fire in particular, because it is so awesomely destructive and so terrifying, that I think really kind of gets at our hearts and maybe lets us feel a little bit of the kind of sense of destruction and doom that may be unleashed by a disrupted planetary climate, you know, over the next 50 years or 100 years or so.
Well, I think of the really ironic juxtaposition of the images of the summer, and I have this picture of these photographs of Houston. Just, I don't know how much it was underwater, but a huge amount of Houston was underwater. And also knowing that there was all this toxic stuff in the water because of how many toxic sites there are all around Houston. And then almost at right after that, then there's the Eagle Creek fire. And then a month later, there's the fire in the wine country in California. And so I have these two images. One is Houston flooded, and then the images, of course, of Puerto Rico, which are even more devastating. And then the scorched earth of Sonoma and Napa and Mendocino counties in California. I wonder, what do we do with that juxtaposition? Because in a way, I feel like it's coming from both angles and pointing at something that I think we're really afraid to look at.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, there's a part of me that, I want to understand the science. I want to understand the natural systems. And then I also want to understand the human psychology that goes into both sort of climate denial that will connect up, I think, with the conversation we'll have a little later about fossil fuels, but that goes into the way that people actually experience disasters like this. You know, I spend a chunk of my summers up in Twist, which is a little town in north central Washington. And two summers ago, my son and I, Sam, were evacuated as the fires came down over the hills toward town. It was quite an alarming experience. I'm confident that will be, you know, maybe his first memory that is kind of seared into his brain. But it occurred to me as we were, you know, driving out and the emergency vehicles were racing in to protect the town, that it was the first time I've been evacuated from a natural disaster. But he's eight now, and there's almost no way that it will be the last time that he is evacuated from a natural disaster. His generation is going to learn to run from disasters, whether it's fire, whether it's flooding, whether it's something else. There's really not a realistic world, if he lives to a ripe old age, which I hope he does, where he's not fleeing natural disasters. And that's a scary proposition, I think.
Yeah. You know, I was just thinking of this little anecdote. A friend of mine sent me a link to a story about a very courageous Great Pyrenees dog who's a goat herder in Sonoma County. And this dog was refusing to leave his goats when the owner had to flee from the fire. And so the owner packed up his kids and his other animals and took off and really felt terrible, really worried about this dog and his goats who he couldn't evacuate. And the next day he broke through the barricades and went back to his place, which was totally burnt down. But on top of this hill was a dog and all the goats. And it's an interesting, the dog had like a little burnt paws and some singed fur, but it was fine. And I think there's something about an idea about survival that that dog had, because he went to this place, he figured out how to get to this place where all the goats were safe. And not only did he have all these goats with him, he had all these deer with him as well. And somehow that's like a metaphor to me of some lesson in resilience that maybe we can learn from this great dog, Odin.
Yeah, what a great story. I hadn't heard that one, but that's really moving. I don't know what lesson to draw from that, but we need a few more of those great Pyrenees dogs in our lives, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I think actually, I mean, maybe there's a lot of lessons we can draw from animals and learning how they're coping. But the other part of it is, of course, we're creating such disasters for so much wildlife, not to mention all the farm animals that I'm not sure how many have got evacuated and how many didn't from the fires in California. I know that all the farm animals in the Corbett area on the west end of the gorge got evacuated from the Eagle Creek fire. But, you know, we just start thinking about our responsibility here on the planet. And it's not just to other humans and to our infrastructure, but it's all the wildlife and domestic animals that we can wreak havoc on their lives as well.
That's right. That's right. And in many senses, I mean, you know, individual people can run away from a fire, hopefully. I mean, that doesn't always happen. But the ecosystem can't run away, and the agricultural animals can't run away, and those things are destroyed. And what's left behind is, you know, sometimes, you know, broken livelihoods, destroyed property, and then the kind of increasing wreckage of the natural systems, which is just, it's hard to bear witness to, I think. And again, I think it connects up to this notion that climate impacts, climate change is beginning to confront us now in ways that are so obvious and so loud and so so terrifying that it does provoke to me this question of like, well, what is the human psychology that allows us to see something like this, to see these events over and over again, and yet at the same time not want to take action about climate change? How is it that we humans do that trick psychologically, where we will sort of bear witness to it and yet absolve ourselves of responsibility for change? And that to me, something in there is kind of the heart of, I think, the challenge that's in front of environmentalists right now, is to figure out how we change that dynamic and begin to take sort of the healthy emotional response, which is to see it, you know, fear it appropriately, and then also make changes to prevent it from getting worse.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning about everything. We're talking, I'm calling this show Fire, Flood, and Trump, and we're talking with Eric DePlace from Sightline Institute. And we're about to talk about some things that are maybe things we can do to work our way into a better paradigm. I was just thinking, as you're talking, Eric, about, you know, getting our priorities straight and how easy it is to have them derailed by unforeseen circumstances. And I think that there were... there's a whole lot of momentum going for some very positive things up until last election. And then we have been so derailed by the Trump administration that it's hard to get back on track. I mean, we're spending so much time being reactive to the horrors that he's trying to perpetrate on us that it's hard to stay focused on what we are needing to be doing. And that's what maybe we can spend the rest of this hour talking about. And I've wanted to actually... kind of start out by talking about some of the very positive things that have happened in the last few weeks. There's been a few successes, so let's start with those.
Sure. The majority of my work over the last many years has been focused on fighting coal and oil and gas export schemes in the Northwest, and that's been really, and strangely, super enjoyable work. I've got to meet lots of folks around the region, and we've had lots of really gratifying success. It all kind of comes under the rubric of preventing, or, you know, helping the Northwest not make the problem any worse. But one of the great things that happened recently was the denial, actually by two state agencies, of permits for a coal export terminal on the Columbia River at Longview, Washington, which would have been the largest coal terminal anywhere in North America. And the State Department of Ecology denied permits for, I think, nine reasons that they cited in their denial. And then the Department of Natural Resources denied a lease for a portion of the aquatic lands. And so what we've seen finally is, two state agencies say, no, this isn't something that is compatible with Washington state law, with our values. It's just, there's all this downside, all these harms that cannot be mitigated. We desperately, obviously, need to move past coal. We need to move past oil and gas, and adapt an entirely new energy system that you know, meets our needs for a climate-changing future. But it is gratifying to finally see some of those big projects run into obstacles and collapse.
Well, before we move on to some of the other positive stories, I just want to add that despite the fact that it looks like a certainty that the Millennium Coal Terminal is history now, is not going to be built, they are going ahead and pursuing other permits. So there's going to be a hearing in Longview this Thursday. It starts at 9 o'clock in the morning, and it runs all day. And actually, there's probably going to be testimony or I guess staff reports going on for several days afterwards. But Columbia River Keepers and other groups that have been fighting this coal terminal are calling to have a party in celebration, actually. So come testify in the early afternoon, and then in the evening or late afternoon to evening, there'll be a dinner in celebration of all the good work that everybody's done to make it very likely. I'd say maybe not absolutely certainty, but I'd say it's very, very likely that the Millennium Coal Terminal is over. So it's going to be happening at the Cowlitz County Conference Center, which is 1900 7th Avenue Southwest in Longview. I'll post that on the website for Locus Focus. And there's going to be a rally at noon, and then the testimony starts after that. So it does seem interesting to me, Eric, that even though this is looking like it's dead, Millennium is still going ahead and trying to get the rest of the permits.
Yeah, they are. They are still there. It's, I mean, my colleague Clark likens them to a zombie. They you know, by all rights are long past dead, but they continue to amble sort of forward or act as if it's alive. They're also mounting a legal challenge as well to the permit denials. But I love the notion of what Columbia Riverkeeper has proposed to do, which is sort of marry up civic engagement and participation in this comment period with a celebration. That's a great model for the way we should act in our communities. So I do hope folks attend. We have to make sure that this thing ends up 6 feet under and stopped for good. But I think it's 99% likely to be that way, but we're not completely sure yet.
Yeah. So. Well, I mean, I think the lesson with Jordan Cove LNG terminal in Coos Bay is it's a scary lesson, which is you think it's dead and then it comes back again.
Right.
These projects don't die an easy death. And I think that we have to be really always vigilant to the fact that even if they look like, I mean, they've been comatose or worse for a long time, that they can still come back to life.
Yeah, that's right, and we do have to always maintain our diligence. The gas companies in particular are well capitalized. They have a viable economic plan in some cases, not in all. Coal less so, but there's still a lot of institutional power behind them. They've got, you know, in some sense, even though that particular coal terminal has actually been swallowed by its creditors, which is a big, its resource capital fund is a big private equity fund. They've got enough money that they want to push this forward, and they've got political support now. So we have to continue to drag them down, and delay and stop these terminals. It's doable. I mean, we've demonstrated over and over again that stopping them is doable, but we can't sort of rest on our laurels too much. Though, that being said, I wanted to sort of go back to what I was saying before. Like, it is really worthwhile, I think, especially in these moments of trouble and darkness, to take some time together with our community members and celebrate the wins that we've had, and realize, I think, and this is what I've enjoyed about the work that I get to do, is I get to travel around the region and meet all of these folks in different communities and different local areas who are fighting fossil fuel projects. And there's something really gratifying about, you know, being face to face with all these different folks who contribute all these different ideas and passions, and together have accomplished what I, you know, what it's hard to believe. It's hard to believe that we've been able to stop all of these projects. I think it's really worthwhile in the era of Trump to gather together with folks who are working for the same ends. And it always gives me a sense of sort of inspiration and hope for the future.
Well, I guess also we haven't mentioned how many coal terminals have been defeated. This wasn't the only one that was being proposed a few years ago.
That's right. There were 6 new coal terminals in Oregon and Washington, plus a 7th in British Columbia, and all of them faced opposition. And one by one, they went down, and they went down for a range of reasons. The tribes were certainly an important factor in that, but they generated huge, robust, kind of deep local opposition, and then region-wide coordinated opposition, and really neat to see that. And then we've seen kind of a parallel campaign spin up around oil-by-rail terminals and oil pipelines, and we're seeing now the beginnings of a new one that will oppose fracked gas and the petrochemical projects that derive from those big fracking operations.
Well, let's move on to fracked gas, because there's also an amazing victory there not that long ago with the Northwest Innovation Works proposal for the world's largest methanol refinery in Kalama. So what happened there?
Yeah, that's another great story. Also on the Columbia River, and so that was a project that was proposed and backed by the Chinese government. It was one of 3 original proposals to take huge amounts of fracked gas down from Canada, refine it into methanol, which is a liquid petrochemical, and then ship it to China, where it would be converted into the plastics ultimately. The first one of those projects was defeated in Tacoma. That was an astonishing victory that did not seem possible at the time. Then there were 2 others in the Columbia, one of which has now gone dormant, and then the other one, the one that you were talking about, is this one at Kalama, which was so far along in the permitting process that I was very skeptical that anybody could stop it. But it turns out that there was a remarkably sustained opposition movement to it that began to grow in power and grow in power. And then Columbia Riverkeeper and Earth Justice mounted a legal challenge that challenged some of the components of the environmental impact statement and won. And so the result of that decision is that the project backers will have to go back and redo their environmental impact statement and correctly calculate its climate impacts. Great precedent for the region, fabulous victory by those organizations, and I mean, talk about escaping by the skin of your teeth. I mean, the community of Kalama really was very, very close to having a huge petrochemical refinery sited right in the center of them. So we don't know if this is a permanent victory or just a delay, but it's certainly good news in either case.
Well, it certainly seems to change the course, because I've been following this for a while, and actually my next project is focusing on this refinery, which in the efforts to try to get it built and the efforts to stop it. And it seemed to me, I went to one hearing about 9 months ago, and it just looked like a done deal. And it was very discouraging to go to that hearing compared to the ones I went to for Millennium and for the Vancouver Energy Terminal, which we're going to talk about in a moment in Vancouver. Because there it seemed like there was so much local support on the part of elected officials, not so much on the part of citizens. So what do you think has shifted in the last 9 months?
Well, I think there are a couple of factors at work, and it's interesting to dig into this. But the environmental community was largely sort of committed and overcommitted to fighting coal and oil, and there really is on some level a resource constraint issue where there are only so many staff people to go around. There are only so many organizers and researchers and so forth. The Kalama methanol refinery, kind of started its permitting process in the slipstream while everyone else was focused on coal and oil. And it wasn't until pretty late in the game that some of the organizations, not all of them, but some began to really pay attention to, these huge gas to methanol projects. And I've said Columbia Riverkeeper about 18 times so far, but they really deserve a lot of credit for this, and begin to say, no, we have to at least try to stop these projects. They did not have the benefit of this big, sustained, muscular, region-wide opposition movement. And even a lot of local folks were, they were busy fighting coal or oil or other projects. So it was much, much harder to create that opposition movement. Now, it happened on a kind of a slower timeline. And then the weird thing that happened, too, that I think acted on it as well was this companion project, the sister project in Tacoma, which, believe it or not, was actually twice as big as the Kalama proposal. So it was not only the biggest methanol project in the world, it was like the times two. It was just shocking. And that proposal in Tacoma went over like a lead balloon. It really, really, I've been involved in a lot of fossil fuel fights around the Northwest over the last years, and I've never seen the intensity and animosity and just rage that Tacoma generated over that project. And when that project, the project backers pulled out. I mean, it was just a politically dead horse there. There's no way they could get that project built in Tacoma. But what happened, I think, is that they sort of opened up a Pandora's box of opposition movement. And then I think it became clear to folks that, no, there actually is enough potential opposition to something like this that you can begin to build a real movement. And so I think Tacoma in some ways acted as an accelerant for the opposition in Kalama. And that's been really positive to see that, communities around the Northwest can kind of connect with one another and support one another.
Well, the other interesting good news, which is not fossil fuel related, has to do with pure water, which is another part of having a good environment, is that Kate Brown finally pulled the plug on Nestle's desire to build a bottled water plant in Cascade Locks. Did you hear about that?
I did not. That's news to me.
Yeah, I got an email, I think, a couple of days ago from Bark. And so what she did is she directed the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Agency, and also there's another water agency in the state, to not make the water rights swap that they were going to make with Cascade Locks, which was going to enable Nestle to get access to this spring water that was very pure. And basically her reasoning was that it's a very expensive and very uncertain future for this potential water bottling plant. And we can't spend money like that when we have such a budget shortfall in the state. So she's using financial reasons for pulling the plug. But whatever reasons it took, it's fine. It's nice that she finally took a stand on that. So
yeah,
I haven't heard a whole lot of celebration about it besides from Bark, who was very involved in getting that stopped. So that was a nice little thing there. And
yeah, definitely.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Eric DePlace with Sightline Institute this morning, and we're talking about, we started out talking about just the confusion and horrors of a world that we've moved into where you can't predict the future from what we've experienced in the past. Everything seems to be off the table now, or on a table or whatever. And we're moving into talking about some issues and actions that people are taking that are actually making a difference. So now I wanted to move on to continue up the Columbia River to Vancouver, Washington, and what's going on there.
Yeah, this is one of the big ones to watch right now. So Vancouver, Washington, is home to this big nasty oil by rail scheme that would be the biggest, I believe, in North America, moving five or six oil trains per day into town, mm-hmm. unloading them into storage tanks, and then onto marine vessels for shipment elsewhere. And that project we think, finally be decided. I mean, well, I've been saying next month, probably for a year now, but I really think that we'll get an answer next month from the governor about whether that project proceeds or not. It's one of those giant fossil fuel projects that has come to town and completely rearranged politics. The opposition movement to it has been extremely robust. That's been heartening. But the project backers are very, very serious. And right now, we're just a few days away from an election, and the project backers have dumped staggering sums of money into trying to retain one seat on the Port Commission that basically keeps them in the game. If they lose that seat, they will probably lose the project, because the port can deny a lease extension for the project backers. But I think last count, Tesoro, the oil company, they've changed their name, I guess, to Endeavor, but Tesoro has, under a couple of different guises, has donated at least $370,000 to one port commissioner running for office, which is not only the most that's ever been spent on a Vancouver Port Commission race, but I think by in any Port Commission race in Washington, probably by double, including Seattle. It is a shocking sum of money for an off-year election. And I think it's really a sign that big oil thinks it's losing, and it's sort of turning to its last and maybe most dangerous weapon, which is being able to dump, you know, huge piles of cash into local races to basically buy democracy.
So who's the candidate who's running against the pro-Tesoro candidate?
Yeah, so Don Orange is running against Chris Green, and Chris Green is the character who's backed by Tesoro Oil. Don Orange has been critical of the lease extensions for that project, and it's believed that he would probably cancel the project in combination with Eric LeBrant, who's already on the Port Commission and opposes the project. And Don Orange has benefited, it's fair to say, from you know, some conservation groups who can do politics, and so, you know, there's much support for him as well. But you know, we've never seen anything like this kind of tidal wave of money come in from the oil industry, really into any race in Washington.
Well, actually, I'd like to give a lot of praise to the Columbian newspaper, which has been doing great investigative coverage of the amount of money that's being dumped by the fossil fuel industry into the race. But my sense is Don Orange is raising money in small dribs and drabs, the kind of Bernie Sanders style. I don't know how much he's raised, but certainly not. I'm sure he hasn't raised as much as his opponent has. But what seems interesting is that almost all the money that's being raised for Green is coming from the oil industry. It doesn't seem like he has any popular base. And I just wonder what that might reflect about what could happen on Election Day.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually funny if you look at the donations. You're absolutely right. I mean, Don Orange's base base of contributors is much broader. And Chris Green's is really they're a very small number of donations, but they're huge. I guess there's so many lessons I want to draw from this. But you know, one of them is that, you know, come Election Day, if Tesoro's candidate wins, I mean, that will sort of be a proof of concept for them that they really can roll into town and essentially buy themselves democracy, buy themselves a candidate who will act according to their wishes. And you're absolutely right to point to the Columbian has done fantastic coverage of this. There's a reporter named Damian Passanti there who's done a lot of the reporting. And one of the things that they've documented is that not only has been giving a lot of money to that campaign, but they've also been essentially running the campaign, writing press releases, doing strategy calls, doing like all of the sort of like nuts and bolts of running a small-time political campaign. The oil company has basically just stepped in and dictated how that's going to go. So, again, it's not that we haven't seen the fossil fuel industry play in politics before. Of course we have, but this is on a scale that is completely unprecedented, at least in the Northwest. This might be something more similar to what you see in a Louisiana or a Texas. I don't really know if actually there's an analog to it, but this is something new.
Well, actually, there is an analog. Dan Snikey, who's one of the organizers against fossil fuel efforts in Southwest Washington, and he's also, I guess, really involved in Don Orange's campaign. And he keeps sending out emails where he says, in 2014, Chevron spent $3 million to elect its slate to the City Council of Richmond, California, and they lost. And I think that that's a thing. I mean, I would actually recommend people read Steve Early's book, Refinery Town, in the next 2 days to just get inspiration for, you know, what a city can do to take back its own political system. And in Richmond's case, it was 100 years of Richmond, of Chevron dominating the city. But in Vancouver, it's exactly the opposite. Vancouver hasn't been dominated by a fossil fuel company. And so I just keep wondering. I haven't been in Vancouver in a few months, actually, and so I don't really have a sense, except from Don's emails, like what's going on. But I do wonder how this is playing out, how effective the articles that the Columbian has been writing have been in raising awareness of voters that this is not the usual. This is as much not usual as having Trump be president.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. You know, I don't know either. I don't really have a good sense of it. But you know, one thing I would say is that it's a good preview. It's like a trailer for a movie. This is what happens when oil companies and coal companies come to town, when they set up shop. This is what happens. And P.S. This is why we need to keep them out, because it doesn't just end up being about the fossil fuel industry. It ends up being about kind of everything. And you can see that in our politics. The places that are dominated by the fossil fuel industry have politics that are not comparable and to the sort of progressive Northwest. And we don't want that. I don't think anybody wants that, really, for the future of the Northwest. And I will say, too, that so Tesoro is playing, and other oil companies are playing big time, in at least one other local race in Washington. And there's we have a special election for a state Senate seat that will probably determine whether our state Senate is controlled by Republicans or Democrats. And they have dumped even more money into that one race. It's in suburban King County near Seattle, you know, where they've got, I think, more than $800,000 last time we counted dumped in to support the Republican candidate there, which, again, is just, it's blowing the doors off any amount of money we've ever seen in a little local race like that.
However, I've been getting emails from Elizabeth Warren and Tom Perez and just about every other Democrat about supporting the Democratic candidate in that race. So I'm not sure that the money's coming in the same way, but certainly there's I was actually a little bit surprised when I started getting these emails, and then I put it together with the paper that you wrote about that race and thought, this is a national race.
Yeah. Yeah, it has in fact become a national race. I think it's you know, in the sense that it will determine the outcome not just of Washington Senate, but basically of which party has control of the state capitol. But at this point, it has been elevated to a national profile, which is probably appropriate because it is a real indicator of whether or not essentially you can have a company come in, an out-of-state company come in and start buying local races like this. Folks who are connected to that campaign are pretty alarmed, pretty outraged, and you know, I guess we'll find out shortly what the outcome will be. But it's true that the Democrat is getting a lot of attention and a lot of money as well.
I'm just curious: are you aware of any polling and how she's doing in the race?
You know, I have not seen any, or if I've seen it, I've forgotten it. I think everyone I've talked to expects it to be a nail biter, so it will likely be close.
And I just have a little proviso here from the Democratic state of Oregon. We've had a completely democratically controlled state capitol, and now with the exception that our Secretary of State is a Republican for the first time in decades. And still, I mean, we had all kinds of wonderful bills on the horizon last session, and almost very, very few of them passed. And things that were just totally reasonable, whether it had to do with climate change or gun control or health issues, they're going to be referred to the ballot. It just seems like even with Democrats in control, it takes something more than just having a Democratic majority sometimes to get things really moving. And an indication that it could be an act from a political leader in either Salem or part of our U.S. congressional delegation could stop Jordan Cove in its tracks, but it's not happening.
Yep, that's a very good point. It is certainly not sufficient to simply have Democratic control of the state legislature or the governor's office to stop these projects. We need progressive leaders of whatever party who get that fossil fuel expansions are bad for the Northwest and are bad for the climate, and who are actually willing to stand up and take action about it. And that is not the case from, I think it's fair to say, from the mainstream Democratic Party in either state. Now, there are leaders out there who will do that, who have done good stuff, and they should be commended for it. But we don't sort of win by having, you know, Democratic control of the state legislature. That's not the end of the game.
You know, actually, just before I came on the air, I was reading my latest posting from Indivisible, and basically, they're focusing this week on the tax reform, in quotes, that's being proposed by the Republican Congress. And that's their focus this week. I'm a little bit nervous that there's so much focusing on that when I think, I read another article on Slate about how we can't wait until Trump fires Mueller or pardons Manafort or whatever to start getting outraged and say, well, that'll be his undoing, that we have to be more proactive and actually stop him from doing these things and really be working on forcing members of Congress, particularly some of the Republicans who are coming out strongly against, the handful of Republicans who are coming out strongly against Trump, to like do something about it. But I was interested in seeing just how much they keep reminding us how much mobilization has helped. And so far to stop the agenda. that Trump is trying to put forward, and that this mobilization could work again to stop this really horrible tax reform that's being proposed. How do you see that we mobilize people? Because it seems like that's the obvious thing, but how do we stay active and engaged?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. That's probably the hardest question I've been asked in a while. I have the luxury of being a researcher, not an organizer, so I don't really know what the magic is that gets people kind of up off their couches and out into their community and interacting with folks. But I think one of the ingredients in that recipe is a belief that we actually can win, that we actually can make a difference. And I don't want to talk about sort of political campaigns right now, but I mean that in a sense that it is large and that applies to political campaigns and applies to everything else that we do. And I think it's one of the reasons why the fossil fuel fights have felt so good for people, is they demonstrate that even against long odds and even against these big, nasty, well-financed corporations, that local communities can stand up and win. It takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of time. But the history of the Northwest over the last 7 years is that local communities have all of the tools they need to make a huge difference and to stop these big projects. And I think if we can take some of that sense that we have power and begin to think about it in the context of our state politics and our national politics, that can really help. I think one of the reasons why Trump was elected in the first place is that people feel disempowered and disenfranchised and left behind by the modern economy, much of which is true, but the only way that gets better is if we actually believe that it can get better and connect with each other and then get out there and start to make a lot of noise. So I'm hopeful that on some level, you know, one of the things we contribute in the Northwest with these fights is a sense of optimism and hope that history is not written for us, that we write it ourselves.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Eric DePlace with Sightline Institute in Seattle, and we're talking about how we can make a difference in what's seeming like an almost overwhelming barrage of everything from bad to just strange, weird events and news that we've been barraged by for the last year. And one more interesting electoral thing that you mentioned in your paper is an election, a ballot measure that's on the ballot in Spokane.
Yeah, it's a curious little ballot measure, and what it would basically do is levy a fee on coal and oil that is transported by rail through the city of Spokane. And there are lots of folks who have raised questions about the legality of that. But sort of leaving aside whether or not a city could legally do something like that, it's been interesting that the city of Spokane has, or some folks in the community there have taken this up, gotten it on the ballot, and then interesting to watch the response that it's provoked, because the folks who are opposing the ballot initiative, that is the folks who want coal and oil to go through, are predictably the railroads that carry the product, this coal company behind the Millennium Coal Terminal at Longview we were talking about earlier, and some others who are willing to spend, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to make sure that there's not a ballot initiative, even one that's of questionable legality, that acts as a referendum on their business model. It's kind of terrifying to them that people would by the popular vote, express their opinions about whether there should be coal and oil transported. And so it's been kind of interesting to kind of smoke out the opposition in that way and see, well, how much is this worth to you? This coal company at Longview is practically bankrupt, and yet they managed to scrounge together, I think, $65,000 or so to dump into opposing this tiny little ballot initiative. So that says something, too, about, I think, how powerful our movement really can be.
Well, I'm thinking about the people in Mosier who experienced horrendous oil train derailment a year and a half ago, and last year had a big fight to stop Union Pacific from widening the tracks right through Mosier so that they could send more trains through more easily. And as far as I know, I think that train track widening was stopped, and it was stopped by the Wasco County Commissioners based in the Dalles, just a few miles down the road, a county that voted overwhelmingly for Trump. But there right. seems to be something, I think that somehow the oil trains, particularly having those fiery images in Mosier of those trains on those cars on fire, does something to people. And maybe we need to have more of reminding people of what the consequences are if we don't act.
I think that's right. I mean, and you're right. The oil trains were galvanizing in part because the derailments and explosions are so visual and so sort of horrifying that it does provide this clarifying function. So yeah, I mean, let's take a referendum in Wasco County. Like, do folks want more oil trains there or not? And I suspect the answer is an overwhelming no, which doesn't actually have anything to do with, you know, Republican or Democratic politics. It's just, it's simply a statement about what's good for this community or not. And that's been one of the fun things too about the fossil fuel fights, is you get to kind of get outside of the whirlpool of national politics and talk about, you know, whether this particular project is good for this community. And in most cases, whether it's a petrochemical refinery or an oil terminal or coal export terminal, what have you, folks don't want that stuff near them in their backyard. They don't want to contribute to that. They don't want to be part of a new fossil fuel economy. They want to be part of a new, cleaner economy. That's a valuable insight, I think, that we haven't maybe done quite enough with yet.
Well, getting back to the Port Commission election in Vancouver, Washington, I'm just thinking about what you said basically is if the Tesoro sponsored, and what they call this, was Endeavor now? Tesoro.
Endeavor.
Endeavor?
Yeah.
Okay, the Endeavor-sponsored, fossil fuel-sponsored candidate wins, your take on that I found rather disconcerting. It sounds like maybe game over for democracy in Washington State.
Well, I think it changes the playing field in a way that's not helpful. I mean, maybe I was a little bit too strong, but I think that basically what it does is it invites more fossil fuel money in, because if they demonstrate that they can flood a race with money and win, there's no chance that they're going to stop with just that one. They'll come back for state Senate seats, for state House seats, for who knows, the governor. Like, they've already been backing anti-tax ballot initiatives. So, you know, they're trying to plan. I think they're trying to figure out how much they need to spend to win. And we've got to make it a problem for them politically. We've got to make it a problem for them in terms of just campaign expenditures. We have to prevent them from spending the kind of money that they probably could spend, because then you end up with a democracy that doesn't look or function like the democracies we've come to rely on in the Northwest.
Well, you've mentioned in other conversations we've had about a lot of oil money that's already been coming into politics in Washington and in Oregon. I wonder if we could talk a little bit about that, and if you see that this is like a bigger deal than the money that's come in before. I'm also curious how much oil money in the past has actually had positive effects for them, that they've actually gotten what they've wanted by throwing a lot of money in elections.
Well, they have spent a few hundred thousand dollars before in various races, mostly in the state Senate, and funding these Tim Emmons-backed ballot initiatives that prevent the state from raising taxes. They do that so that that taxes or fees are not levied on petroleum products. But I would say they've probably gotten a fairly decent return on investment. Actually, like, they have by supporting a few targeted Senate candidates, particularly Senator Doug Erickson, who's from Northwest Washington, they have been able to retain control barely of the state Senate in Washington and of some key committee chairmanships. And by having that one lever of control, they have prevented the state from acting on much stricter regulation of oil transport. Washington has 5 oil refineries, so that regulatory structure really matters, from increasing fees or taxes on oil products. And a bunch of other things. They've stopped carbon taxes at the state level. And so they are spending money to protect their bottom line. They think of this probably as a business proposition as much as they think of it as an ideological war. And that's a problem. Now, if they think they can do even more, and then particularly that local level, the Port Commission level, county commissioners make a lot of important decisions, we would like to prevent them from kind of extending their tentacles even further into those institutions, because I really don't think anything positive flows from that.
And then the sense that I've gotten with the time that I spent in Vancouver in the last couple of years, it seems to me there's overwhelming opposition to Tesoro there. It's both
right.
From the hearings and from city council meetings that I've attended and just from what I've heard from people who live there. And so I think about, there's, I think, a pretty public knowledge now of just how connected the port is with Tesoro, how they're really bedfellows. And yeah. That I had a very clear image of that where I was, for my last documentary, I interviewed a spokesperson for the port. And then the next week I went to interview a spokesperson for Savage, who was the collaborated with Tesoro for the refinery. And so I'm supposed to meet him at the port, which I thought was interesting. And I go to the port, and then the person who I'd interviewed at the port introduces me to this person and takes me to him. So I thought, I mean, how transparent can you be about what the connections are between Savage Tesoro and how much control they have over the port?
Yeah, that's a really interesting story. I mean, that's incredible. In many of these places, we saw this in Aberdeen and Hoquiam as well. Vancouver is certainly a good illustration of it. The city councils are unanimously opposed to the project. The reason the ports have backed them is that historically, and this is changing fast now, ports have kind of operated sort of in the shadows and without much attention and oversight, even though they are the port commissions are elected, and they kind of have these old school economic development mandates. But to the extent that the public is involved, and that's usually through city council or other mechanisms, the opposition is completely overwhelming. People don't want it. And by one measure of that, I mean Vancouver has rezoned itself to prevent the construction of large oil storage facilities. That doesn't apply to the permit that was already on the table, this one by Tesoro we're talking about, but it applies to the future, so that they another project like this could not come back on the table. And that zoning ordinance change was approved unanimously by city council. So people there do not want a project like this. It's just a few narrow special interests that do.
And I wonder if that will show it on Election Day.
Yeah, I sure hope so. I sure hope people are connecting the dots, because, this is really what I mean by saying it's a subversion of democracy. Is, I think it's pretty clear that the people do not want this project, and yet there are a few mechanisms by which the oil companies or whomever can subvert the will of the people and build and operate something like this that isn't good for the local community. So I do hope folks are paying attention on Election Day, protecting their own interests.
Well, Eric, it's always good to talk to you. And I'm thinking that the next time we talk should be around January 20th, when you're going to unseal part two of your time capsule that you instituted about back in last January 20th.
That sounds like a fabulous idea, Barbara. Thanks for having me on the show again.
Sure. Okay. Well, we'll talk soon. Thanks a lot. We've been talking with Eric DePlace, who is Sightline Institute's policy director, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and would like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll talk about plastic pollution with Marcus Erickson, who's author of Junkraft. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Abby Lincoln. Thanks for listening.
Some folks I used to know, used to smile and say hello, spin the world and turn the page, entertaining from the stage. But father time forever true, loves its own and me and you, disappear just like the sun when the day is done. The world is falling down.